I've known Father Frank since he was ordained. Most of you know that. He came to my parish, all right, in St. Charles, Staten Island, and that's how I got involved in all this. And he preached tirelessly about abortion in our parish, and we had a wonderful pastor who let him do it and let him do all kinds of things. All right, he became the first full-time director of Priests for Life. He didn't found it. It was already established, but three priests part-time, and they wanted someone full-time, so they voted Father their first full-time director with the permission of Cardinal O'Connor, and he's been at it ever since. Father's an energizer bunny. He sleeps, here and there in between planes. He's traveled to all 50 states and most continents, a few he hasn't hit, although he prefers staying in the United States. And you know he all does lots and lots of media. He basically also is our tech guru. He heads up our IT department, right, Will? Yep, Will could tell you. He knows just as much as those IT guys. In fact, all our databases that we have, all this work for the 115, Father Frank created it, all right, with the tech guys helping a little bit, but it's his tech mind. He thinks of data, so important. And some of you could take a page out of this book, that back when Father was my parish priest, he started collecting names even when he was a seminarian, even before that. He volunteered in Bible studies. He always had contact information. And back in the old days, that's before databases were built, he had us volunteers typing up lists for him and lists for him and lists. And that's how we started, you know, our priest life going. They gave him a small list of people, and he's grown it tremendously because he always walks around with a pad of paper in his pocket and a pen. So, and if you don't have a business card, he's going to take down your information. So he works tirelessly, and he does want to end abortion in his lifetime. He's very determined, and it's his passion. And now I'll introduce Father because he wants to give you guys a little opening talk, and then we'll go to break, and then we're going to start diving deeper into the topics that are on your agenda. So, Father, you can have the microphone.
Okay. I'll use the one that's on here.
Oh.
Thank you very much, Janet, and thank you all again for being here. This facility is enriched by your presence, and all of us are enriched by our collaboration throughout the course of the year. And it's about that collaboration that I want to provide some thoughts and perspective, not only to set the tone for the discussions of today and tomorrow, but to provide you some encouragement about the path forward. We have all been called to be leaders in this movement to end abortion. Brothers and sisters, it is a movement that is deserving of the full-time sacrificial involvement that we all give it. It's not something that you and I feel drawn, as so many people seem to be, or seem to feel the need to do, that when we're starting to talk about the unborn, all of a sudden we have to invoke every other issue under the sun. We know that we are committed to the sanctity of human life, and we often say in the Catholic community, the phrase is from conception to natural death. Yes, of course. Of course. But how many issues does that involve? A few million? This is a movement that has come about because of a specific problem relating to a specific group of people. The children in the womb have been deprived of protection of their most fundamental right, the right to life. That's the sense in which we are the pro-life movement. Not that we're a movement that's obliged to address every issue under the sun. Fixing the potholes in your town's roads is a pro-life issue, because if those holes remain and the driver doesn't see them, that can affect the quality or even existence of life. Every issue is a pro-life issue, otherwise it wouldn't be an issue at all. But we can't let that dilute the focus of why and how this particular movement came about and why and how you and I have gotten involved in it. We are here to end abortion. And brothers and sisters, we will. One of the roles we have as leaders is not only to manage and grow our organizations, produce our resources, and achieve particular victories legislatively, politically, or serve in the pregnancy centers or the healing after abortion, or all the different ministries we do. Our role as leaders is deeper than that. We need to provide for the people of this movement the perspective that they need to stay in the movement or to be attracted to it in the first place and to persevere in the work. The perspective. And what do people need as much as they need food, water, and oxygen? They need meaning. We give meaning to the work that our brothers and sisters in this movement do. And that's how we ask ourselves, how can we encourage, how can we motivate the people that serve with us in this cause? Well, one of the ways we motivate them is we give them meaning and perspective. Look at a few of the perspectives that we need to give to the people in this movement. We know that we have been privileged to live through something that Norma McCorvey, the Jane Roe of Roe v. Wade, and Nellie Gray, the founder of the March for Life, and Joe Shidler, the godfather of pro-life activism, didn't have the privilege to see this side of heaven. We got to live through the reversal of Roe v. Wade. And brothers and sisters, I like to think of it as the gears of a car, because I don't know that our movement has fully assimilated yet or communicated to our people the significance of the reversal of Roe. I don't know that we have. But it's like the gears of a car, because under Roe, we were in reverse. The courts were saying, you cannot protect the unborn. Dobbs put us into neutral. The court said, you may protect the unborn. It's up to you. People and their elected representatives, you want to protect them? There's no constitutional reason for us to stop you. We're in neutral right now. We've got to get into drive where the court says you must protect the unborn. And that, of course, the work of Alan Parker and pro-life attorneys who have been discussing and promoting the idea that the right to life is, in fact, not only in the Declaration, but also in the Constitution, paves the way for this eventually happening, which I believe it will happen, because it's the only logical place to be as Americans and as human beings. Of course, we must protect the unborn, no less than we must protect the born. But brothers and sisters, the perspective here, for people to think in the slightest way that the Dobbs victory means that we pay less attention to the abortion battle or we can sit on the sidelines, the reality is just the opposite. If we're in neutral now and the court is saying, yes, you may protect the unborn, well, then we step on the gas and we do it. Because for the same work we've been doing for five decades, we get more bang for the buck. We get more results. The work is the same. People say, oh, what changes in the pro-life movement? Not much. Oh, a return to the states. It was already in the states. How did Dobbs come about in the first place? It was state action in Mississippi, like state action had been taken in a lot of other places. The battle's always been in the states. The difference now is that for the same work we do, persuading people, electing people, passing pro-life laws, for the same work that we do in the same way, we get more results, because then those pro-life laws don't get struck down. And then we had, of course, the second greatest victory in the One Big Beautiful Bill, finally getting Congress to turn off the biggest flow of money into the abortion industry. Brothers and sisters, that is a tremendous victory that we need to help our people appreciate and celebrate. And of course, what do we often hear and say with justification? Oh, well, but it was supposed to be for 10 years, and now it's only for 1 year. Only for 1 year. Would we have really been satisfied if it was 10 years? What are you going to do in the 11th year? Say, okay, I'm okay now with funding abortion once the 11th year comes? No, 10 years would not be enough. What if it were permanent? Permanent, taxpayer, no funding of abortion anymore. We still can't be satisfied with that. We don't want to just defund abortion. We want to abolish it. So, in other words, the point I'm making is we as leaders provide meaning and perspective to our people and thereby motivation and encouragement. And therefore, we need to be careful as a movement that we're giving adequate attention and proper explanation to the significance of the victories we have. Otherwise, how are we going to encourage our people to work for more victories? Of course, we're dissatisfied. We have to be dissatisfied. I want to talk to you for a moment about impatience and dissatisfaction at the core of our calling to be leaders in this great movement. William Wilberforce, speaking to Parliament and insisting that the question of the slave trade be dealt with here and now, without further delay, addressed his colleagues when they called for suspending the question. Oh, we can't do that right now. I'll talk about that later. And Wilberforce responded, the question suspended? Is the desolation of wretched Africa suspended? Are all the complicated miseries of this atrocious trade, is the work of death suspended? No, we're not going to delay the motion. And wasn't that same divine impatience expressed by Martin Luther King Jr. in his letter to the Birmingham jail? He said, and I quote, frankly, I've yet to engage in a direct action campaign that was well-timed in the view of those who have not suffered unduly from the disease of segregation. For years now, I've heard the word wait. It rings in the ear of every Negro with a piercing familiarity. This wait almost always means never. And then, of course, he went from there into the famous line, justice too long delayed is justice denied. Yes, we're impatient. Brothers and sisters, here's our challenge as leaders: to foster in ourselves and in our people that constant and divine and urgent impatience, and combine it with human patience that is born of understanding the realities we deal with in this world, and how, for example, the political and legislative processes work. We don't find success in this movement if the articulation of the principles that we adhere to is devoid of an understanding of how to make those principles change public policy. Nor is it, of course, effective at all to try to advance a public policy that you don't know what the principle is that's behind it. But we need both. We're obliged to both. It comes down to the fact that this mission is not something we choose. It chooses us. We're human beings. Where does the pro-life movement come to? You know, if we as national leaders in this movement did a press conference right here and now, and we turned on the cameras, we went into our studio here down the hall, we broadcast a press conference saying that we were dismantling the pro-life movement, it wouldn't work. If we all walked away from this work today, it wouldn't dismantle the movement, because you know what? We didn't start it. It arose from the grassroots. It arose, grassroots in the deepest sense of the word. It arises from the human heart. It arises from the basic human instinct that we got to protect our children. It arises from the kitchens and the living rooms and the water coolers of America over decades and decades. It has arisen. We're just needed for a little bit of time to maybe organize and direct some of that energy, but it's not like it came from us. It comes from our very humanity. It comes from our conscience. We did not choose this battle. This battle chose us. We don't adjust this battle to what's convenient for us. We adjust our lives to the battle. And you know what else we didn't choose? We didn't choose the limitations that we face in winning this battle. This is a crucially important point. We didn't choose the limitations. So often in this movement, and people like Tom and others of you here who go way back to the beginning, and were in the discussions and the debates and the divisions of this movement in the 1980s, about how do we do this? Constitutional amendment, personhood, incremental legislation. How do we do this? Brothers and sisters, we don't choose incrementalism. Incrementalism chooses us. We don't choose the limits that we have physically. If we're here at this meeting, we can't be praying out in front of the abortion clinic at the same time on the same day. Does that mean we don't care about the babies being killed at that abortion clinic? Or someone who says, well, I got to be just at the clinic all the time, 24/7. God bless them, but you can only be at one at a time. If you're praying in front of or rescuing in front of, we endorse our rescue activities, and it's morally and biblically sound. But if I'm rescuing at a clinic in New York, I can't simultaneously be rescuing at a clinic in California. And that doesn't mean I care any less about the babies in California. Limitations are not something we choose. Exceptions in legislation that won't pass without them, I didn't choose those exceptions. They chose me. It's beyond my competence, it's beyond my control, and it's beyond my decision that some people in a legislative body aren't ready to vote for the right kind of legislation, and therefore it's not going to pass. That's not my fault. That's not my decision, and nothing I can do about it, except to continue to try to persuade. But that's completely different from dealing with the limitation that's right in front of you right at that very moment. Yes, we're dissatisfied. Yes, we're impatient. And yes, we're also patient because we're wise, because we know how the process works and we know how to deal with the limitations that we face. But brothers and sisters, I want to say to you today, as leaders in this movement in February of 2026, and I hope I can encourage you on this point as we continue to have our meetings, this moment now is the best moment for the pro-life movement that we've ever had in America. This moment now, the months directly in front of us, the year that we have just started, I'm saying to you today, it is my deep conviction, this is the golden moment for this movement. Why do I say that? Not only because of what I've already pointed out about the two absolutely tremendous decades longed for victories that we have now in our pocket, but because of something else. And we can't miss this. The victories we are enjoying right now in this movement aren't just about legislation passed, abortion clinics closed, or the numbers of abortions. The limits, the challenges aren't just about some off-the-cuff comments that the president might make or some challenges we face in this state or that state. Again, you and I are leaders in this movement. We've got to provide perspective for people. And here's the perspective I want to encourage you to provide. We, as a movement in America, as we're about to celebrate our 250th birthday, are witnessing an unprecedented protection of the tools we need to do this work, and we are witnessing an unprecedented demolishing of the tools that the other side has relied on for decades. Let me just give you a few examples. The freedom of speech is being defended more strongly right now in America than it ever has, with our administration currently dealing with those who censor free speech and using funding as a pressure point to say, you are no longer going to silence Americans. Establishing, even for the clergy in the pulpit, by executive order, a freedom that we've missed for decades. You wonder why. Again, this is not explicitly dealing with abortion, but it's dealing with abortion and it's dealing with the success of our movement, because one of the things we all face, and we're going to discuss it tomorrow, the role of the church in all of this, is the silence from the pulpits. What pro-life group doesn't want to see more vocal dealing with this issue from the pulpit? And why is there that silence? Because of this ridiculous Johnson Amendment. And the way that clergy have been told, shut up. You know why so clergy are so silent? Because they've been told to be. And they've been threatened. And they've been laboring under the illusion that they give one sermon about voting pro-life and the whole tax-exempt status of the church from coast to coast is going to disappear the next morning before 10 o'clock. And we have finally been set free from this just last week. Once again, the President of the United States referred to an executive order he signed 4 months after being inaugurated the first time, saying to clergy, you say what you want. I've gotten more, as a member of the clergy myself, more encouragement from our president than I have from my bishops. He has stood up and said to America, we need your voice, clergy. We need the church. We need you to speak your mind. The obstacle and the pro-abortion side has relied on that fear, on that silence, on that chilling effect of a Johnson Amendment, which in and of itself is not only unconstitutional, but what's worse is the way that it has been exaggerated and spun and weaponized to scare us into silence. Religious freedom. Nothing more has ever been done for religious freedom than we're experiencing right at this minute. Just the other day, I was at another one of these hearings for the Religious Liberty Commission. Some of you may have been at those meetings. They happen approximately every month. Where the president is saying to experts, I want to do more. Tell me what more I can do. It literally already has done more than anybody could do for religious freedom. He wants more. And established a task force to deal with anti-Christian bias. Do we as leaders know what anti-Christian bias means? It means pro-abortion bias. And he's established a task force to literally cleanse, purge this scourge from America once and for all. And you know how that's been happening also? He's been purging the people who stand in our way. The people who stand in our way to establish protection for the unborn are not only the Democrat pro-abortion lawmakers that we've dealt with for decades. It's the unelected bureaucrats who constitute by the thousands those deep state personnel. Here's what happens. People elect an administration to pursue an agenda. Pro-life is often a motive for that, right? And then policies get crafted by think tanks and other agencies. And, hey, this sounds like a good pro-life policy, or this sounds like a good pro-life law. And then nothing sees the light of day. Nothing gets done. And we have meetings with the people from the White House. Hey, how come we didn't hear anything about this? Or how come nothing was done about that? Or how come that thing seemed to just die on the vine? You know why? One of the big reasons is? Because the people who are tasked with carrying out the will of the voters as expressed through the agenda of the administration were not elected by those voters, didn't start with that administration. They think they're in there for life. They look at one presidential administration after another like we look at the changing of the seasons, and they think they can do what they want. And they do what they want. And if they don't agree with the pro-life agenda, you know what they do? They'll ignore the job they're being done to implement pro-life policies, or they'll slow walk it, or they'll do exactly the opposite. And they feel that they're not accountable. The current administration has made them more accountable. And do you know how many federal employees have been purged from the federal workforce just in the last few months? Over 317,000. Now, I'm not saying that every one of them is one of these deep state pro-abortion bureaucrats. But you know what? This includes the deep state pro-abortion bureaucrats that have been shown the door. Why? Because the people who run the government should be the people that we elect to run the government, not some kind of nameless, faceless, pro-abortion obstructionists. They're being purged. The thought control agencies are being purged. You may have read about the groups like the Disinformation Governance Board, the DGB, or the State Department's Global Engagement Center, the GEC, or the Voice of America's parent organization, the USAGM. These are entities, again, you have these big entities, they work behind the scenes, they're usually not in the headlines, they're often not on our radar, and yet they're obstructing our work and hindering our success because they're trying to take Disinformation Governance Board was an attempt under the Biden administration for the government to start to discern what's true and what's false. What do you think they're going to say about abortion? What do you think they're going to say about the humanity of the unborn? It was dismantled. All three of these agencies and others were dismantled. Why? Because of radical propaganda. And where do you think that radical propaganda stands on our issue? Social media, free speech. I remember being down the hallway there in 2020 and 2021 and doing programs, and our director of social media and broadcasting, Rob, whom you met yesterday, would be saying to me, okay, Father, remember, when we turn on these cameras, you can't say anything about stolen elections or about the COVID vaccines. Can't say anything. I mean, I never felt the oppression, like during those months that we had to deal with that garbage. No more. No more. Look what's happened with X, with Elon Musk, even Meta, increasing on Facebook freedom of speech last year, taking away, reducing the content restrictions, phasing out the third-party fact-checking, and they replaced it with community notes. Good, let the people decide by more speech about what's true and what's false. That's how you sort out truth from falsehood, by encouraging more speech, not by censoring the speech that you think is wrong. Secular media, CBS. What happened with CBS? They did that 60 Minutes interview with Kamala Harris, and they edited it to make it sound like she could put two sentences together, which wasn't the case. And President Trump called them out on it. $16 million settlement, including an agreement that from now on, they have to publish the full transcripts of every presidential candidate interview going forward. You think that doesn't help our cause? You think that doesn't put these other media outlets on notice that what they've been getting away with for decades isn't going to be tolerated anymore in the United States of America? And that's a victory for our movement, because it's in those interviews and it's through those outlets that the pro-abortion movement gets their job done. That's how it happens. We have a divine impatience about ending abortion. We have a human patience born of the fact that we know how these things work, and we know what's necessary to stop them. Academia, the universities. Now, the transgender ideology is tied in deeply with the abortion ideology. You've heard me say, most of you, why is it that we can't say a man is a man or a woman is a woman in 2026 in America? Because for 50 years, we've been saying a baby's not a baby. You want to deny basic biological truth? Go ahead. It's part of the same cloth, is it not? Deny a baby is a baby. Got as much evidence that that baby's a baby as you have that I'm a man or you're a woman. You got as much evidence. And yet, if you deny it, well, then you can deny it wherever you want. So it was the University of Pennsylvania that allowed women who said that they were men to take away the titles from women who had won in the sports competition on their campus. And thanks to the work that we see being done now in America to dismantle these ideologies, to dismantle these strongholds, that university was brought to the point that they apologized, reversed their protocol, and gave the award to the women who actually won those competitions. This is a major victory. We saw victories like this at Cornell, at Columbia, at Brown. And some 50 other universities were investigated for alleged discrimination against whites and Asian American students. And all of this ideology is tied right into the core of the pro-abortion movement. Securing our elections. You see what happened recently in Georgia? The FBI went in there and give me the ballots. This is not theoretical anymore. Give me the ballots. They went in and collected them. And they're being reviewed right now. Whether there was fraud in our elections isn't going to be a matter of speculation anymore. It's going to be a matter of concrete evidence, and this administration is going in to get it. The SAVE Act, we're going to discuss that a little bit this afternoon. One of the most important pieces of legislation in front of Congress right now to secure our elections and to make sure that the people voting are the ones who are constitutionally permitted to vote, American citizens. You think that doesn't affect our movement? We know it does. Because who benefits from cheating in elections? The pro-abortion candidate. So we're not even talking here with a partisan motivation. We're talking here with a pro-life motivation. What do we do to end abortion? We got to get pro-life candidates elected. What elects pro-abortion candidates? Fraud, fraud, and more fraud. And the sooner we stop that fraud, the sooner we get to our pro-life goal. School choice. Again, how does this impact our movement? That in the big, beautiful bill that was signed into law in July, do you realize that there was the first and largest federal funding of school choice that has ever taken place in American history? It's going to kick in 2027, actually. So a lot of these things, they're on a timeline because it's required by the way things work. Agencies have to prepare all the paperwork and all the processes. But school choice has gotten a tremendous, unprecedented boost. And what movement does that benefit, may I ask? Obviously, that benefits the pro-life agenda, not the pro-abortion agenda. Parents who want to pass on to their children the values and convictions that you and I work for every day now are going to have more freedom to do exactly that. And I maintain for you, brothers and sisters, in this bigger perspective that we need to use to inspire our movement, that we might be living right now in one of the great awakenings. There have been in our history the first great awakening, the second, 18th century we're talking about. Some would point to other awakenings. You know, you don't know them when you're going through them necessarily. But you know, the first great awakening, I mean, basically what was happening was that Christians were standing up and saying, enough of this enlightenment nonsense. It's not just about human reason. It's about the Word of God. It's about not just conclusions you come to rationally. It's about conversion you come to through the Holy Spirit. I maintain we may be living right now a moment in America, and therefore a moment in our pro-life movement, that history's going to look back and say, great awakening. Whatever number you want to give it, great awakening, number four, number five, whatever it is, it's happening now. And how do we back that up? Bible sales are unparalleled right now. You know this, right? 20% increase in 2023, another 11% increase in 2024, and sales in 2025 have reached already over 18 million copies of the greatest book ever written. Why? What's going on? Well, what's going on is very simple. The Bible contains truth. The Bible contains moral guidance, and people are sick of not having it. We need meaning just as much as we need food and water and oxygen. We need meaning. Our young people need meaning. And they're not getting it in their universities. They're not getting it on social media. They're not getting it from their families, because their families don't exist anymore, because the left has destroyed the family. And so they're going to the Bible. And they're going to church. Our friend George Barna has been talking about increased church attendance among Gen Z and millennials, about twice as much as, well, not quite twice as much, but more than the boomers and the elders. And who tends to be more pro-life, people who go to church regularly or those who don't? Across denominations, obviously, it's those who do. Because the idea of worshiping is exactly the opposite idea of pro-choice. Pro-choice, I decide. Worshiping, Lord, you decide. Prayer in schools. Now we're talk about something timely. A week ago today, the National Prayer Breakfast, the president announced new guidance coming out from the Department of Education that says the following. Teachers and staff in schools, public schools, must be permitted to pray while at work on the same terms as students. This is with the understanding there's no coercion involved here. Nobody wants to force anybody to do anything against their conscience. We're just talking about the right to pray. Visible personal prayer, and I'm quoting from the directive, even if there's a voluntary student participation in such prayer, does not in itself constitute coercion. The other side always tries to say that it does. Oh, they made me feel forced to pray. Who's going to benefit if we have more prayer in public schools? What movement is going to benefit in the abortion wars? Which one? Obviously ours. And on May 17th, there's going to be a national gathering on the Mall to rededicate America as one nation under God. Who benefits from that? If we're under God, we're not under abortion. And DEI, well, as far as that nonsense goes, numerous companies have pulled back, scaled down, or completely eliminated diversity, equity, and inclusion programs, including Google, Meta, Amazon, Pepsi, Target, and Ford. Are we winning on this? Absolutely. And another point I bring up as a final example of, you know, this perspective is that the United States has pulled out recently of no fewer than 66 international organizations, entities, movements, and treaties that are pro-abortion and that fund abortion. 31 of them are United Nations entities. 35 of them are non-UN entities. But they are some of the biggest bulwarks that the pro-abortion movement has relied on nationally and internationally. Entities such as the UN Population Fund that supports global and sexual reproductive health. And also a group called UN Women and 64 others. And the U.S. pulling out of them means what? That the money is pulling out of them. And that they're not going to be able to impose their agenda anymore through these agencies on not only our country, but other countries who are trying to protect the unborn children and are told, sorry, but you can't do it. Brothers and sisters, we have impatience and patience at the same time. We battle the same obstacles that our founders did. And this is why it's so appropriate in this meeting, as you know by the decorations in the office, the focus on America 250. When our founders adopted the Constitution, they were dealing with the moral issue of slavery. You know, I presume, that in the Constitution, although the timetable for it has now expired, but it's still in the wording of the Constitution, the provision was made that for 20 years there could be no federal ban on slavery. But the founders were against it in principle, as a body. Why did they put in the Constitution that it could not be banned for 20 years by Congress? For a very simple reason. The states were divided, slave and free. And if they hadn't put that in there, they wouldn't have been able to have a Constitution to begin with. And when they got a Constitution to begin with, what was the vehicle ultimately by which slavery was abolished? The Constitution. Divine impatience, human patience combined, got it done. You and I now are dealing with a battle even more basic than slavery. Life and death for our youngest brothers and sisters. And brothers and sisters, I want to conclude with a thought that comes from the era of fascism in Spain, when it was taking hold there at the University of Salamanca. There was a ceremony, I think it was a commencement ceremony, and a speech was given. And by one of Franco's agents, pro-fascism speech. And the president of the university was a man by the name of Unamuno. And he was sitting there steaming because in the speech, and he addressed it afterwards despising what had just been said. In that speech, this fascist speaker got the students chanting something. And you know what they were chanting? Viva la muerte. Long live death. And that president of that university got up and said, this is absurd. This is absurd. It's a self-contradiction. And he said, you may have power to impose this on people, but you will never convince. All these agencies I just talked about, the deep state, the media, academia, all of this censorship, everything we've been dealing with, fraud in elections, the power of the pro-abortion movement, they can impose, but they cannot convince. And that's why we're still here. People wonder, but they should have finished off the pro-life movement by now. There's no way. You can't do it. Because you can never convince people that viva la muerte makes any sense at all. You can't. It was attributed to Osama bin Laden, this quote, showing the heart of a terrorist, and I would say showing the heart of the pro-abortion movement. He said, we win because we love death more than you love life. And as we meet today, as we consider intelligently and honestly and with the deepest commitment to principle what we need to do next as a movement, let's resolve that we're going to love life more than they love death. That's how we win. People in 2024 voted in America, believers voted, because they were convinced this was not just an election between two candidates or two parties. This was a choice between good and evil. Didn't you hear that all over the country? We're going to win the elections of 2026 only if we can make the case to believers with the same force that this is just as much a battle between good and evil in this election as it was 2 years ago. And that the same things, not the same names,